He also felt he could never do enough to please my grandfather. Baba had beautiful handwriting, and my father would spend hours painstakingly drawing letters, but Baba never once said it was good. My grandmother kept his spirits up. He was her favorite, and she believed great things lay in store for him. She loved him so much that she would slip him extra meat in the cream of the milk while she went without. But it wasn't easy to study as there was no electricity in the village in those days. He used to read by the light of the oil lamp in the hujra, and one evening he fell asleep. The oil lamp had fallen over, but fortunately my grandmother found him before a fire started. It was my grandmother's faith in my father that gave him the courage to find the middle ground, a proud path he could travel along. This is the path he would later show me. Yet she too got angry with him once. Holy men from a spiritual place called the Rai Saidan used to travel the villages in those days begging for flour. One day, while his parents were out, some of these Sayeds came to the house. My father broke the seal on the wooden storage box of maize and filled their bowls. When my grandparents came home, they were furious and beat him. The Pashtuns are famously frugal, though generous with guests. But Baba was particularly careful with money. If any of his children accidentally spilt their food, he would fly into a rage. He was an extremely disciplined man and could not understand why they were not the same. As a teacher, he was eligible for a discount on his son's school fees for sports and joining the Boy Scouts. It was such a small discount that most teachers did not bother, but he forced my father to apply for the rebate. Of course, my father detested doing this. As he waited outside the headmaster's office, he would break out into a sweat. Once inside the office, his stutter was worse than ever. "It felt as if my honor was at stake for 5 rupees, he told me. My grandfather never bought him new books. Instead, he would tell his best students to reserve their old books for my father at the end of the year, and then he would be sent to their homes to get them. He felt ashamed, but had no choice if he didn't want to end up illiterate. All his books were inscribed with other boys' names, never his own. "It's not that passing books on is a bad practice," he says. "It's just I so wanted a new book, unmarked by another student, and bought with my father's money." My father's dislike of Baba's frugality has made him a very generous man, both materially and in spirit. He became determined to end the traditional rivalry between him and his cousins. When that headmaster's wife fell ill, my father donated blood to help save her. The man was astonished and apologized for having tormented him. When my father tells me stories of his childhood, he always says that though Baba was a difficult man, he gave him the most important gift, the gift of education. He sent my father to the government high school to learn English and receive a modern education, rather than sending him to a madrasa, even though as an imam, people criticized him for this. Baba also gave him a deep love of learning and knowledge, as well as a keen awareness of people's rights, which my father has passed on to me. In my grandfather's Friday addresses, he would talk about the poor and the landowners and how true Islam is against feudalism. He spoke Persian and Arabic and cared deeply for his words. He read the great poems of Sa'di, Allama Iqbal and Rumi to him with such passion and fire, it was as if he was teaching the whole mosque. My father longed to be eloquent with a voice that boomed out with no stammer. He knew my grandfather desperately wanted him to be a doctor, but though he was a very bright student and a gifted poet, he was poor at maths and science and felt he was a disappointment. That's why he decided he would make his father proud by entering the district's annual public speaking competition. Everyone thought he was mad. His teachers and friends tried to dissuade him, and his father was reluctant to write the speech for him. But eventually, Baba gave him a fine speech, which my father practiced and practiced. He committed every word to memory whilst walking in the hills and reciting it to the skies and birds, as there was no privacy in their home. There was not much to do in the area where they lived, so when the day arrived, there was a huge gathering. Other boys, who were known as good speakers, gave their speeches. Finally, my father was called up. "I stood at the lectern," he told me, "hands shaking and knees knocking, so short I could barely see over the top, and so terrified the faces were a blur. My palms were sweating, and my mouth was as dry as paper." He tried desperately not to think about the treacherous consonants lying ahead of him, just waiting to trip him up and stick in his throat. But as he spoke, the words came out fluently across the hall like beautiful butterflies taking flight. His voice did not boom like his father's, but his passion shone through, and as he went on, he gained confidence. At the end of the speech, there were cheers and applause. Best of all, as he went up to collect the cup for first prize, he saw his father clapping and enjoying being patted on the back by those standing around him. "It was," he says, "the first thing I'd done that made him smile." After that, my father entered every competition in the district. My grandfather wrote the speeches, and he almost always came first, gaining a reputation locally as an impressive speaker. My father had turned his weakness into strength. For the first time, my grandfather started praising him in front of others. He'd boast, "Ziyadin is Shaheen," which means falcon, because it is a creature that flies high above others. "You write your name as Ziyadin Shaheen," he told him. For a while, my father did this, but stopped when he realized that although a falcon flies high, it is a cruel bird. Instead, he just called himself Ziyadin Yusufzai, our clan name. 3. Growing up in a school. My mother started school when she was 6 and stopped the same term. She was unusual in the village as she had a father and brothers who encouraged her to go to school. She was the only girl in a class of boys. She carried her bag of books proudly into school and claims she was brighter than the boys. But every day she would leave behind her girl cousins playing at home, and she envied them. There seemed no point in going to school to just end up cooking, cleaning, and bringing up children. So one day, she sold her books for 9 annas, spent the money on boiled sweets, and never went back. Her father said nothing. She says he didn't even notice, as he would set off early every morning after a breakfast of cornbread and cream, his German pistol strapped under his arm, and spend his days busy with local politics or resolving feuds. Besides, he had 7 other children to think about. It was only when she met my father that she felt regret. Here was a man who had read so many books, who wrote her poems she could not read, and whose ambition was to have his own school. As his wife, she wanted to help him achieve that. For as long as my father could remember, it had been his dream to open a school. But with no family contacts or money, it was extremely hard for him to realize this dream. He thought there was nothing more important than knowledge. He remembered how mystified he had been by the river in his village, wondering where the water came from and went to, until he learnt about the water cycle from the rains to the seas. His own school in the village had been just a small building. Many of his classes were taught under a tree on the bare ground. There were no toilets, and the pupils would be sent to the fields to answer the call of nature. Yet, he says, he was actually quite lucky. His sisters, my aunts, did not go to school at all, just like the millions of girls in my country. Education had been a great gift for him. He believed that lack of education was at the root of all Pakistan's problems. Ignorance allowed politicians to fool people and bad administrators to be re-elected. He felt schooling should be available for all, rich and poor, boys and girls. The school that my father dreamt of would have desks and a library, computers, bright educational posters on the walls, and most importantly, washrooms. My grandfather had a different dream for his youngest son. He longed for him to be a doctor. And as one of just two sons, he expected him to contribute to the household budget. My father's elder brother, Saeed Ramzan, had worked for years as a teacher at a local school in the mountains. He and his family lived with my grandfather, and whenever he saved up enough of his salary, they built a small concrete hujra at the side of the house for guests. He brought logs back from the mountains for firewood, and after teaching, he would work in the fields where our family had a few buffaloes. He also helped Baba with heavy tasks like clearing snow from the roof. When my father was offered a place for his A-levels at Zenhansep College, which is the best further education institution in Swat, my grandfather refused to pay for his living expenses. His own education in Delhi had been free. He had lived like a talib in the mosques, where local people provided the students with food and clothes. Tuition at Zenhansep was free, but my father needed money to live on. Pakistan doesn't have student loans, and he had never even set foot in a bank. The college was in Saidu Sharif, the twin town of Mingora, and he had no family there with whom he could stay. There was no other college in Shangla, and if he didn't go to college, he would never be able to move out of the village and realize his dream. My father was at his wit's end and wept with frustration. His beloved mother had died just before he graduated from school. He knew if she had been alive, she would have been on his side. He pleaded with his father to relent, but to no avail. His only hope was his brother-in-law from Karachi. My grandfather suggested that they might take my father in so he could go to college there. The couple would soon be arriving in the village as they were coming to offer condolences after my grandmother's death. My father prayed they would agree. But my grandfather asked them as soon as they arrived, exhausted after the 3-day bus journey. His son-in-law refused outright. My grandfather was so furious he refused to speak to them for their entire stay. My father felt he had lost his last chance, and that he would end up like his brother teaching in a local school. The school where Uncle Khan Dada taught was in the mountain village of Siwur, about an hour and a half's climb from their house. It didn't even have its own building. They used the big hall in the mosque in which they taught more than 100 children ranging from 5 to 15 years old. The people in Siwur were Gujars, Kohistanis, and Mians. We regard Mians as noble or landed people, but Gujars and Kohistanis are what we call hilly people, peasants who look after buffaloes. Their children are usually dirty and looked down upon by our village people, even though they are poor themselves. They are dirty, black and stupid, people would say. Let them be illiterate. It is said that teachers don't usually like to be posted to those remote schools, and generally made a deal with their colleagues so that only one of them would go to work each day. If the school had two teachers, each would go for 3 days and sign the other in. If they had three teachers, each would go for just 2 days. Once there, all they were concerned with was to keep the children quiet with a long stick, as they could not imagine education would be any use to them. My uncle was more dutiful. He liked the hilly people and respected their tough lives. So he went to the school most days and actually tried to teach the children. After my father had graduated from school, he had nothing to do, so he volunteered to help his brother. There, his luck changed. Another of my aunts had married a man in that village, and they had a relative visiting called Nasir Pacha, who saw my father at work. Nasir Pacha had spent years in Saudi Arabia, working in construction, making money to send back to his family. My father told him he had just finished school and had won a college place at Zenhansep. He did not mention he could not afford to take it, as he did not want to embarrass his father. "Why don't you come and live with us?" asked Nasir Pacha. "Oof, I was so happy by God," says my father. Pacha and his wife Jajai became his second family. Their home was Sappal Bandi, a beautiful mountain village on the way to the White Palace, which my father says was a romantic and inspirational place. My father went there by bus. The village seemed so big to him compared to where he was born that he thought he'd arrived in a city. As a guest, he was treated exceptionally well. Jajai replaced his late mother as the most important woman in my father's life. When villagers complained to her he was flirting with a girl living across the road, she defended him. Ziauddin is as clean as an egg with no hair, she said. Look instead to your own daughter. It was in Suppalbandi where my father encountered women who had great freedom and were not hidden away, as in his own village. The women of Suppalbandi had a beautiful spot on top of the mountain where only they would congregate to chat about their everyday lives. It was unusual for women to have a special place to meet outside the home. It was also there that my father met his mentor, Akbar Khan, who, although he had not gone to college himself, lent my father money so he could. Like my mother, Akbar Khan may not have had much of a formal education, but he had another kind of wisdom. My father often told the story of the kindness of Akbar Khan and Nasir Pacha to illustrate that if you help someone in need, you might also receive unexpected aid. My father arrived at college at an important moment in Pakistan's history. That summer, while my father was walking in the mountains, our dictator, General Zia, was killed in a mysterious plane crash, which people said was caused by a bomb hidden in a crate of mangoes. During my father's first term at college, national elections were held, which were won by Benazir Bhutto, daughter of the Prime Minister who had been executed when my father was a boy. Benazir was our first female Prime Minister, and the first in the Islamic world. Suddenly, there was a lot of optimism about the future. Student organizations which had been banned under Zia became very active. My father quickly got involved in student politics and became known as a talented speaker and debater. He was made General Secretary of the Pakhtun Students' Federation, PSF, which wanted equal rights for Pashtuns. The most important jobs in the army, bureaucracy and government are all taken by the Punjabis because they come from the biggest and most powerful province. The other main students' organization was Islami Jamaat-e-Talba, the student wing of the religious party Jamaat-Islami, which was powerful in many universities in Pakistan. They provided free textbooks and grants to students, but held deeply intolerant views, and their favorite pastime was to patrol universities and sabotage music concerts. The party had been close to General Zia and done badly in the elections. The president of their students' group in Zenhabzev College was Ishanul Haq Haqqani. Though he and my father were great rivals, they admired each other and later became friends. Haqqani says he is sure my father would have been president of the PSF and become a politician if he had been from a rich Khan family. Student politics was all about debating and charisma, but party politics required money. One of their most heated debates in that first year was over a novel. The book was called The Satanic Verses by Salman Rushdie and was a parody of the Prophet's life set in Bombay. Muslims widely considered it blasphemous, and it provoked so much outrage that it seemed people were talking of little else. The odd thing was that no one had even noticed the publication of the book to start with. It wasn't actually on sale in Pakistan. But then a series of articles appeared in our Urdu newspapers by a mullah close to our intelligence service, berating the book as offensive to the Prophet and saying it was the duty of good Muslims to protest. Soon mullahs all over Pakistan were denouncing the book, calling for it to be banned. Angry demonstrations were held. The most violent was held in Islamabad on 12th February 1989, when American flags were set alight in front of the American Center, even though Rushdie and his publishers were British. Police fired into the crowds and five people were killed. The anger wasn't just in Pakistan. 2 days later, Ayatollah Khomeini, the supreme leader of Iran, issued a fatwa calling for Rushdie's assassination. My father's college held a heated debate in a packed room. Many students argued that the book should be banned and burnt and the fatwa upheld. My father also saw the book as offensive to Islam, but believed strongly in freedom of speech. First, let's read the book, and then why not respond with our own book, he suggested. He ended by asking in a thundering voice my grandfather would have been proud of, "Is Islam such a weak religion that it cannot tolerate a book written against it? Not my Islam." For the first few years after graduating from Zehanseb, my father worked as an English teacher in a well-known private college. But the salary was low, just 1,600 rupees a month, around $19, and my grandfather complained my father was not contributing to his household. It was also not enough for him to save for the wedding he hoped for to his beloved Tor Pekai. One of my father's colleagues at the school was his friend Mohammad Naim Khan. He and my father had studied for their bachelor's and master's degrees in English together and were both passionate about education. They were also both frustrated. As the school, it was very strict and unimaginative. Neither the students nor the teachers were supposed to have their own opinions. The owner's control was so tight, they even frowned upon friendship amongst the teachers. My father longed for the freedom that would come with running his own school. He wanted to teach independent thought and hated the way the school he was at rewarded obedience above open-mindedness and creativity. So when Naim lost his job after a dispute with the college administration, they decided to start their own school. Their original plan was to open a school in my father's village of Shahpur, where there was a desperate need. "Like a shop in a community where there are no shops," he said. But when they went there to look for a building, there were banners everywhere advertising a school opening. Someone had beaten them to it. So they decided to set up an English medium school in Mingora, thinking that since Swat was a tourist destination, there would be a demand for learning in English. As my father was still teaching at SPS, Naim wandered the streets looking for a place to rent. One day, he called my father excitedly to say he'd found the ideal spot. It was the ground floor of a two-story building in a well-off area called Landikas, with a walled courtyard where students could gather. The previous tenants had also run a school, Ramada School. The owner got the name because he had once been to Turkey and seen a Ramada hotel. But the school had gone bankrupt, which perhaps should have made them think twice. Also, the building was on the banks of a river where people threw their rubbish and it smelt foul in hot weather. My father went to see the building after work. It was a perfect night with stars and a full moon just above the trees, which he took to be a sign. "I felt so happy," he recalls. "My dream was coming true." Naim and my father invested their entire savings of 60,000 rupees. They borrowed 30,000 rupees more to repaint the building, rented a shack across the road to live in, and went from door to door trying to find students. Unfortunately, the demand for English tuition turned out to be low, and there were unexpected drains on their income. My father's involvement in political discussions continued after college. Every day his fellow activists came to their home or school for lunch. "We can't afford all this entertaining," Naim would complain. It was also becoming clear that while they were best friends, they found it hard to work as business partners. On top of that, there was a stream of guests who arrived from Shangla now that my father had a place for them to stay. We Pashtuns cannot turn away relatives or friends, however inconvenient. We don't respect privacy, and there is no such thing as making an appointment to see someone. Visitors can turn up whenever they wish. They can stay as long as they want. It was a nightmare for someone trying to start a business, and it drove Naim to distraction. He joked to my father that if either of them had relatives to stay, they would have to pay a fine. My father kept trying to persuade Naim's friends and family to stay so he might be fined too. However, after 3 months, Naim had had enough. We're supposed to be collecting money in enrollment fees, he complained. Instead, the only people knocking on our doors are beggars. This is a Herculean task, he added. I can't take any more. By this time, the two former friends were hardly speaking to each other and had to call in local elders to mediate. My father was desperate not to give up on the school, so agreed to pay Naeem a return on his share of the investment. He had no idea how. Fortunately, another old college friend called Hidayatullah stepped in and agreed to put up the money and take Naeem's place. The new partners again went from door to door, telling people they had started a new kind of school. My father is so charismatic that Hidayatullah says he is the kind of person who, once invited to your house, will make friends with your friends. But while people were happy to talk to him, they preferred to send their children to established schools. They named the school Khushal School after one of my father's great heroes, Khushal Khan Khattak, the warrior poet from Akora, just south of Swat, who tried to unify all Pashtun tribes against the Mughals in the 17th century. Near the entrance, they painted a motto: "We are committed to build for you the call of the new era." My father designed a shield with a famous quote from Khattak in Pashto: "I girt my sword in the name of Afghan honor." My father wanted us to be inspired by our great hero, but in a manner fit for our times, with pens, not swords. Just as Khattak wanted Pashtuns to unite against a foreign enemy, so we needed to unite against ignorance. Unfortunately, not many people were convinced. When the school opened, they had just 3 students. Even so, my father insisted on starting the day in style by singing the national anthem. Then his nephew Aziz, who had come to help, raised the Pakistan flag. With so few students, they had little money to equip the school and soon ran out of credit. Neither man had any money from their families. Hidayatullah was not pleased to discover that my father was still in debt to lots of people from college, so they were always receiving letters demanding back the money. There was worse in store when my father went to register the school. After being made to wait for hours, he was finally ushered into the office of the official of schools, who sat behind towering piles of files surrounded by hangers-on drinking tea. "What kind of school is this?" asked the official, laughing at his application. "How many teachers do you have?" 3? "Your teachers are not trained. Everyone thinks they can open a school just like that." The other people in the office laughed along, ridiculing him. My father was angry. It was clear the official wanted money. Pashtuns cannot stand anyone belittling them. Nor was he about to pay a bribe for something he was entitled to. He and Hidayatullah hardly had money to pay for food, let alone bribes. The going rate for registration was about 13,000 rupees, more if they thought you were rich. And schools were expected to regularly entertain the officials for a good lunch of trout from the river or chicken. The education officer would call to arrange an inspection, then would give a detailed order for his lunch. My father used to grumble, "We're a school, not a poultry farm." So when the official angled for a bribe, my father turned on him with all the force of his years of debating. "Why are you asking all these questions?" he demanded. "Am I in an office or am I in a police station or a court? Am I a criminal?" He decided to challenge these officials and protect other school owners from such bullying and corruption. He knew that to do that, he needed some power of his own. He joined an organization called the Swat Association of Private Schools. It was small in those days, just 15 members, and my father quickly became vice president. The other principals took paying bribes for granted, but my father argued that if all the schools joined together, they could resist. "Running a school is not a crime," he told them. "Why should you be paying bribes? You are not running brothels. You are educating children. Government officials are not your bosses," he reminded them. "They are your servants. They are taking salaries and have to serve you. You are the ones educating their children. My father soon became president of the organization and expanded it until it included 400 principals. Suddenly, the school owners were in a position of power. But my father has always been a romantic rather than a businessman. And in the meantime, he and Hidayatullah were in such desperate straits that they ran out of credit with the local shopkeeper and could not even buy tea or sugar. To try and boost their income, they ran a sweet shop at school, going off in the mornings and buying snacks to sell to the children. My father would buy maize and stay up late at night making and bagging popcorn. I would get very depressed and sometimes collapse seeing the problems all around us, said Hidayatullah. But when Ziauddin is in crisis, he becomes strong and his spirits high. My father insisted that they needed to think big. One day, Hidayatullah came back from trying to enroll pupils to find Ziauddin sitting in the office with the local head of Pakistan TV talking about advertising. As soon as the man had gone, Hidayatullah burst into laughter. Ziauddin, we don't even have a TV, he pointed out. If we advertise, we won't be able to watch it. But my father is an optimistic man and never deterred by practicalities. One day, my father told Hidayatullah he was going back to his village for a few days. He was getting married, but he had not told any of his friends in Mingora as he could not afford to entertain them. Our weddings go on for several days of feasting. In fact, my mother often reminds my father he was not there for the actual ceremony. He was only there for the last day when family members held a Quran and a shawl over their heads and held a mirror for them to look into. For many couples in arranged marriages, this would be the first time they see each other's faces. A small boy was brought to sit in their laps to encourage the birth of a son. It is our tradition for the bride to receive furniture or perhaps a fridge from her family and some gold from the groom's family. My grandfather would not buy enough gold, so my father had to borrow more money to buy bangles. After the wedding, my mother moved in with my grandfather and my uncle. My father returned to the village every 2 or 3 weeks to see her. The plan was to get his school going, then once it was successful, send for his wife. But his father kept complaining about the drain on his income and made my mother's life miserable. She had a little money of her own, so they used it to hire a van and she moved to Mingora. They had no idea how they would manage. We just knew my father didn't want us there, said my father. At that time, I was unhappy with my family, but later I was grateful as it made me more independent. He had, however, neglected to tell his partner. Hidayatullah was horrified when my father returned to Mingora with a wife. We're not in a position to support a family, he told my father. Where will she live? It's okay, replied my father. She will cook and wash for us. My mother was excited to move to Mingora. To her, it was a modern town. When she and her friends had discussed their dreams as young girls by the river, most had just said they wanted to marry and have children and cook for their husbands. When it was my mother's turn, she said, I want to live in the city and be able to send out for kebabs and naan instead of cooking it myself. However, life wasn't quite what she expected. The shack had just 2 rooms. One where Hidayatullah and my father slept together, and one which was a small office. There was no kitchen, no plumbing. When my mother arrived, Hidayatullah had to move to the office and sleep on a hard wooden chair. My father consulted my mother on everything. Pekai, help me resolve my confusion on this, he would say. She even helped whitewash the school walls, holding up the lanterns so they could paint when the light went off in power cuts. Ziauddin was a family man and they were unusually close, said Hidayatullah. While most of us can't live with our wives, he couldn't be without his. Within a few months, my mother was expecting. Their first child, born in 1995, was a girl and stillborn. I think there was some problem with hygiene in that muddy place, says my father. I assumed women could give birth without going to hospital, as my mother and my sisters had in the village, My mother gave birth to 10 children in this way. The school continued to lose money. Months would pass and they could not pay the teacher's wages or the school rent. The goldsmith kept coming and demanding his money for my mother's wedding bangles. My father would make him good tea and offer him biscuits in the hope that would keep him satisfied. Hidayatullah laughed. You think he will be happy with tea? He wants his money. The situation became so dire that my father was forced to sell the gold bangles. In our culture, wedding jewelry is a bond between the couple. Often, women sell their jewelry to help set up their husbands in business or to pay their fares to go abroad. My mother had already offered her bangles to pay for my father's nephew to go to college, which my father had rashly promised to fund. Fortunately, my father's cousin, Jahan Sher Khan, had stepped in. She did not realize the bangles were only partly paid for and was furious when she learned that my father did not get a good price for them. Just when it seemed matters could not get worse, the area was hit by flash floods. There had been torrential rain all day, and in the late afternoon, there was a warning of flooding. Everyone needed to leave the district. My mother was away, and Hidayatullah needed my father to help him move everything up to the first floor, safe from the fast rising waters, but he couldn't find him anywhere. He went outside shouting, "Ziauddin! Ziauddin!" The search almost cost Hidayatullah his life. The narrow street near the school was totally flooded, and he was soon up to his neck in water. There were live electric cables hanging and swaying in the wind. He watched, paralyzed with fear, as they almost touched the water. Had they done so, he would have been electrocuted. When he finally found my father, he learned that he had heard a woman crying that her husband was trapped in their house, and he had rushed in to save him. Then he helped them save their fridge. Hidayatullah was furious. "You saved this woman's husband, but not your own house," he said. "Was it because of the cry of a woman?" When the waters receded, they found their home and school destroyed. Their furniture, carpets, books, clothes, and the audio system. The school building was caked in thick, foul-smelling mud. They had nowhere to sleep and no clean clothes to change into. Luckily, a neighbor called Mr. Amandeen took them in for the night. It took them a week to clear the debris. They were both away when 10 days later there was a second flood and the building again filled with mud. Shortly afterwards, they had a visit from an official of WAPDA, the Water and Power Company, who claimed their meter was rigged and demanded a bribe. When my father refused, a bill arrived with a large fine. There was no way they could pay this, so he asked one of his political friends to use his influence. It started to feel as though the school was not meant to be, but my father would not give up on his dreams so easily. I was born on 12th July 1997. My mother was helped by a neighbor who had delivered babies before. My father was in the school waiting, and when he heard the news, he came running. My mother was worried about telling him he had a daughter, not a son. But he says he looked into my eyes and was delighted. "Malala was a lucky girl," says Hidayatullah. "When she was born, our luck changed. But not immediately." On Pakistan's 50th anniversary on 14th August 1997, there were parades and commemorations throughout the country. However, my father and his friends said there was nothing to celebrate. Swat had only suffered since it had merged with Pakistan. They wore black armbands to protest, saying these celebrations were for nothing and were arrested. They had to pay a fine they could not afford. A few months after I was born, the 3 rooms above the school became vacant and we all moved together. The walls were concrete and there was running water, so it was an improvement on our muddy shack. But we were still very cramped as we were sharing it with Hidayatullah and we almost always had guests. That first school was a mixed primary school and very small. By the time I was born, it had 5 or 6 teachers and around 100 pupils paying 100 rupees a month. My father was teacher, accountant and principal. He also swept the floors, whitewashed the walls and cleaned the bathrooms. He used to climb up electricity poles to hang banners advertising the school, even though he was so afraid of heights that when he got to the top of the ladder, his feet shook. If the motor of the water pump stopped working, he would go down the well to repair it himself. When I saw him disappear down there, I would cry, thinking he wouldn't come back. After paying the rent and salaries, there was little money left for food. We drank green tea, as we could not afford milk for regular tea. But after a while, the school started to break even, and my father began to plan a second school, which he wanted to call the Malala Education Academy. I had the run of the school as my playground. My father tells me, even before I could talk, I would toddle into classes and talk as if I was a teacher. Some of the female teachers, like Miss Ulfat, would pick me up and put me in their laps as if I was their pet, or even take me home with them for a while. When I was 3 or 4, I was placed in classes for much older children. I used to sit in wonder, listening to everything they were being taught. Sometimes I would mimic the teachers. You could say I grew up in a school. As my father found with Naeem, it is not easy to mix business and friendship. Eventually, Hidayatullah left to start his own school and they divided the students, each taking 2 of the 4 years. They did not tell their pupils as they wanted people to think the school was expanding and had 2 buildings. Though Hidayatullah and my father were not speaking at that time, Hidayatullah missed me so much he used to come by to visit me. It was while he was visiting one afternoon in September 2001 when there was a great commotion and other people started arriving. They said there had been a big attack on a building in New York. 2 planes had flown into it. I was only 4 and too young to understand. Even for the adults, it was hard to imagine. The biggest buildings in Swat are the hospital and a hotel, which are 2 or 3 stories. It seemed very far away. I had no idea what New York and America were. The school was my world, and my world was the school. We did not realize then that 9/11 would change our world too, and would one day bring war into our valley. 4. The village. In our tradition, on the 7th day of a child's life, we have a celebration called Woma, which means 7th, for family, friends and neighbors to come and admire the newborn. My parents had not held one for me because they could not afford the goat and rice needed to feed the guests, and my grandfather would not help them out because I was not a boy. When my brothers came along and Baba wanted to pay, my father refused, as he hadn't done this for me. But Baba was the only grandfather I had, as my mother's father had died before I was born, and we became close. My parents say I have qualities of both grandfathers, humorous and wise like my mother's father, and vocal like my father's father. Baba and I became close, as he had grown soft and white-bearded in his old age, and I loved going to visit him in the village. Whenever he saw me, he would greet me with a song as he was still concerned about the sad meaning of my name and wanted to lend some happiness to it. Malala maiwand walada dapa patu yahan keda khushalada, he sang. Malala is of Maiwand, then she's the happiest person in the whole world. We always went to the village for Eid holidays. We would dress in our finest clothes and pile into the flying coach, a minibus with brightly painted panels and jangling chains, and drive north to Barkhana, our family village in Shangla, in Upper Swat. Eid happens twice a year. Eid ul-Fitr, or small Eid, marks the end of the Ramadan fasting month, and Eid ul-Azha, or big Eid, commemorates the Prophet Abraham's readiness to sacrifice his son Ishmael to God. The dates were announced by a special moon sighting panel of clerics who watch for the appearance of the crescent moon. And as soon as we heard it on the radio, we set off. The night before, we hardly slept because we were so excited. The journey usually took about 5 hours, as long as the road had not been washed away by rains or landslides and the flying coach left early in the morning. We struggled to the Mingora bus station, our bags laden with gifts for our family, embroidered shawls and boxes of rose and pistachio sweets, as well as medicine they could not get in the village. Some people took sacks of sugar and flour, and most of the baggage was tied to the top of the bus in a towering pile. Then we crammed in, fighting over the window seats, even though the panes were so encrusted with dirt, it was hard to see out of them. The sides of Swat buses are painted with scenes of bright pink and yellow flowers, neon orange tigers and snowy mountains. My brothers liked it if we got one painted with F-16 fighter jets or nuclear missiles, though my father said if our politicians hadn't spent so much money on building an atomic bomb, we might have had enough for schools. We drove out of the bazaar, past the grinning red mouth signs for dentists, the carts stacked with wooden cages crammed with beady-eyed white chickens with scarlet beaks, and jewelry stores with windows full of gold wedding bangles. The last few shops as you head north out of Mingora are wooden shacks that all seem to lean on each other, in front of which are piles of reconditioned tires for the bad roads ahead. Then we were on the main road built by the last Wali, which follows the wide Swat River on the left and hugs the cliffs to the right with their emerald mines. Overlooking the river were tourist restaurants with big glass windows we had never been to. On the road, we passed dusty-faced children bent double, with huge bundles of grass on their backs, and men leading flocks of shaggy goats that wandered hither and thither. As we drove on, the landscape changed to paddy fields of deep, lush green that smelled so fresh, and orchards of apricot and fig trees. Occasionally, we passed small marble works over streams which ran milky white with the discharge of chemicals. This made my father cross. "Look at what these criminals are doing to pollute our beautiful valley," my father always said. The road left the river and wound upwards through narrow passes over steep fir-clad heights, higher and higher until our ears popped. On top of some were ruins where vultures circled, the remains of old forts built by the first Wali. The bus strained and labored, the driver cursing as trucks overtook us on blind bends with steep drops below. My brothers loved this, and they would taunt me and my mother by pointing out the wreckage of vehicles on the mountainside. Finally, we made it up onto Sky Turn, the gateway to Shangla Top, a mountain pass which feels as if it's on top of the world. Up there, we were higher than the rocky peaks all around us. In the far distance, we could see the snows of Malam Jabba, our ski resort. By the roadside were fresh springs and waterfalls, and when we stopped for a break to use the washroom and drink some tea, the air was clean and fragrant with cedar and pine. We breathed it into our lungs greedily. Shangla is all mountain, 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 just small sky. After this, the road winds back down for a while, then follows the Wurban River and peters out into a rocky track. The only way to cross the river is by rope bridges or on a pulley system by which people swing themselves across in a metal box. The Angrezi call them suicide bridges, but we love them. If you look at a map of Swat, you'll see it is one long valley with little valleys we call Dare, off to the sides like the branches of a tree. Our village lies about halfway along and to the east. It's in the Kanna Valley, which is enclosed by craggy mountain walls and so narrow there's not even room for a cricket ground. We call our village Shapur, but really there is a necklace of three villages along the bottom of the valley. Shapur, the biggest, Barkana, where my father grew up, and Karshat, which is where my mother lived. At either end is a huge mountain. Torgar, the Black Mountain to the south, and Spingarh, the White Mountain, to the north. We usually stayed in Barkana at my grandfather's house where my father grew up. Like almost all the houses in the area, it was flat-roofed and made of stone and mud. I preferred staying with my cousins because they had a concrete house with a washroom and there were lots of children to play with. My mother and I stayed in the women's quarters downstairs. The women spent their days looking after the children and preparing food to serve to the men in their hujra upstairs. I slept in a room with my cousins Anisa and Sumbul, which had a clock in the shape of a mosque and a cabinet on the wall containing a rifle and some packs of hair dye. In the village, the day started early, and even I, who like to sleep late, woke with the sound of cocks crowing and the clatter of dishes as women prepared breakfast for the men. In the morning, the sun was reflected at the top of Torgarh, the Black Mountain. When we got up for the first prayers, we would look left and see the golden peak of Spingarh, the White Mountain, lit with the first rays of the sun, like a white lady wearing a Juma Tika or gold chain on her forehead. Often, rain would then come to wash everything clean, and the clouds would linger on the green terraces of the hills where people grew radishes and walnut trees. Dotted around were hives of bees. I loved the gloopy honey they made, which we ate with walnuts. Down on the river at the Karshat end were water buffaloes. There was also a shed with a wooden water wheel providing power to turn huge millstones to grind wheat and maize into flour, which the young boys would then pour into sacks. Next to that was a smaller shed containing a panel with a confusion of wires sprouting from it. The village received no electricity from the government, so many villagers got their power from these makeshift hydroelectric projects. As the day went on, and the sun climbed higher in the sky, more and more of the White Mountain would be bathed in golden sun. Then as evening came, it fell in shadow as the sun moved up the Black Mountain. We timed our prayers by that shadow of the sun on the mountain. When the sun hit a certain rock, we used to say our asr or afternoon prayers. Then in the evening, when the white peak of Spingarh was even more beautiful than in the morning, we said the maqam, or evening prayers. You could see the White Mountain from everywhere, and my father told me he used to think of it as a symbol of peace for our land, a white flag at the end of our valley. When he was a child, he used to think that this small valley was the entire world, and that if anyone went beyond the point where either mountain kissed the sky, they would fall off. Though I had been born in a city, I shared my father's love of nature. I loved the rich soil, the greenness of the plants, the crops, the buffaloes, and the yellow butterflies that fluttered about me as I walked. The village was very poor, but when we arrived, our extended family would lay on a big feast. There would be bowls of chicken, rice, local spinach, and spicy mutton, all cooked over the fire by the women, followed by plates of crunchy apple, slices of yellow cake, and a big kettle of milky tea. None of the children had toys or books. The boys played cricket in a gully, and even the ball was made from plastic bags tied together with elastic bands. The village was a forgotten place. Water was carried from the spring. The few concrete houses had been built by families whose sons or fathers had gone south to work in the mines or to the Gulf, from where they sent money home. There are 40 million Pashtuns, and 10 million of them live outside our homeland. My father always said it was sad that they could never return, as they needed to keep working to maintain the family's new lifestyle. There were many families with no men. They would visit only once a year, and usually a new baby would arrive 9 months later. Scattered up and down the hills, there were houses made of wattle and daub, like my grandfather's, and these often collapsed when there were floods. Children sometimes froze to death in winter. There was no hospital. Only Shahpur had a clinic, and if anyone fell ill in the other villages, they had to be carried there by their relatives on a wooden frame, which we jokingly called the Shangla ambulance. If it was anything serious, they would have to make the long bus journey to Mingora, unless they were lucky enough to know someone with a car. Usually, politicians only visited during election time, promising roads, electricity, clean water and schools, and giving money and generators to influential local people we called stakeholders, who would instruct their communities on how to vote. Of course, this only applied to the men. Women in our area don't vote. Then they disappeared off to Islamabad if they were elected to the National Assembly, or Peshawar for the Provincial Assembly, and we'd hear no more of them or their promises. My cousins made fun of me for my city ways. I did not like going barefoot. I read books, and I had a different accent, and used slang expressions from Mingora. My clothes were often from shops, and not homemade like theirs. My relatives would ask me, "Would you like to cook chicken for us?" And I'd say, "No, the chicken is innocent. We should not kill him." They thought I was modern because I came from town. They did not realize people from Islamabad or Peshawar would think me very backward. Sometimes we went up to the mountains and sometimes down to the river on family trips. It was a big stream, too deep and fast to cross when the snows melted in summer. The boys would fish using earthworms, threaded like beads on a string that hung from a long stick. Some of them whistled, believing this would attract the fish. They weren't particularly tasty fish. Their mouths were very rough and horny. We call them chakwati. Sometimes a group of girls would go down to the river for a picnic with pots of rice and sherbet. Our favorite game was weddings. We would get into two groups, each supposed to be a family. Then each family would have to betroth a girl so we would perform a marriage ceremony. Everyone wanted me in their family, as I was from Mingora and modern. The most beautiful girl was Tanzila, and we often gave her to the other group so we could then have her as our bride. The most important part of the mock wedding was jewelry. We took earrings, bangles, and necklaces to decorate the bride, singing Bollywood songs as we worked. Then we would put makeup on her face that we'd taken from our mothers, dip her hands in hot limestone and soda to make them white, and paint her nails red with henna. Once she was ready, the bride would start crying, and we would stroke her hair and try to convince her not to worry. "Marriage is part of life," we said. "Be kind to your mother-in-law and father-in-law so they treat you well. Take care of your husband and be happy." Occasionally, there would be real weddings with big feasts that went on for days and left the family bankrupt or in debt. The brides would wear exquisite clothes and be draped in gold, necklaces and bangles given as her dowry by both sides of the family. I read that Benazir Bhutto insisted she would only wear glass bangles to set an example, but the tradition of adorning the bride still continued. Sometimes a plywood coffin would be brought back from one of the mines. The women would gather at the house of the dead man's wife or mother, and a terrible wailing would start and echo round the valley, which made my skin crawl. At night, the village was very dark, with just oil lamps twinkling in houses on the hills. None of the older women had any education, but they all told stories and recited what we call tappa, Pashto couplets. My grandmother was particularly good at them, and they were usually about love or being a Pashtun. "No Pashtun leaves his land of his own sweet will," she would say. "Either he leaves from poverty or he leaves for love." Our aunts scared us with ghost stories, like the one of Shalgwate, the 20-fingered man who they warned would sleep in our beds and we would cry in terror. Though in fact, as the word for toe and finger in Pashto is the same, we were all 20-fingered men, but we didn't realize. To make us wash, the aunts told stories about a scary woman called Shashaka, who would come after you with her muddy hands and stinking breath if you didn't take a bath or wash your hair, and turn you into a dirty woman with hair like rat's tails filled with insects. She might even kill you. In the winter, when parents didn't want the children to stay outside in the snow, they would tell a story about the lion or tiger, which must always make the first step in the snow. Only when the lion or tiger has left their footprint are we then allowed to go outside. As we got older, the village began to seem boring. The only television was in the hujra of one of the wealthier families. No one had a computer. Women in the village hid their faces whenever they left the parda quarters and could not meet or speak to men who were not their close relatives. I wore more fashionable clothes and didn't cover my face, even when I became a teenager. One of my male cousins was angry and asked my father, "Why isn't she covered?" He replied, "She is my daughter. Look after your own affairs." But some of the family thought people would gossip about us and say we were not properly following Pashtunwali. I am very proud to be a Pashtun, but sometimes I think our code of conduct has a lot to answer for, particularly where the treatment of women is concerned. A woman named Shahida, who worked for us and had three small daughters, told me her tragic story. When she was only 10 years old, her father sold her to an old man who already had a wife but wanted a younger one. When girls disappeared, it was not always because they had been married off. There was a beautiful 15-year-old girl called Seema. Everyone knew she was in love with a boy, and sometimes he would pass by and she would look at him from under her long dark lashes, which all the girls envied. In our society, for a girl to flirt with any man brings shame on the family, though it's all right for the man. Later, we were told she had committed suicide, but we later discovered her own family had poisoned her. We have a custom called swara, where a girl can be given to another tribe to resolve a feud. It is officially banned, but still continues. In our village, there was a widow, Sureya, who married a widower from another clan which had a feud with her family. Nobody can marry a widow without the permission of her family. When Sureya's family found out about the union, they were furious. They threatened the widower's family until a jirga was called of village elders to resolve the dispute. The jirga decided that the widow's family should be punished by handing over their most beautiful girl to be married to the least eligible man of the rival clan. The boy was a good for nothing, so poor that the girl's father had to pay all their expenses. Why should a girl's life be ruined to settle a dispute she had nothing to do with? When I complained about these things to my father, he told me that life was harder for women in Afghanistan. The year before I was born, a group called the Taliban, led by a one-eyed mullah, had taken over the country and was burning girls' schools. They were forcing men to grow beards as long as a lantern and women to wear burqas. Wearing a burqa is like walking inside a big fabric shuttlecock with only a grill to see through, and on hot days, it's like an oven. At least I didn't have to wear one. He said that the Taliban had even banned women from laughing out loud or wearing white shoes, as white was a color that belonged to men. Women were being locked up and beaten just for wearing nail varnish. I shivered when he told me such things. I read my books like Anna Karenina and the novels of Jane Austen and trusted in my father's words, "Malala is free as a bird." When I used to hear the stories of the atrocities in Afghanistan, I felt proud to be in Swat. Here, a girl can go to school, I used to say. But the Taliban were right around the corner and were Pashtuns like us. For me, the valley was a sunny place, and I couldn't see the clouds gathering behind the mountains. My father used to say, "I will protect your freedom, Malala. Carry on with your dreams." 5. Why I don't wear earrings and Pashtuns don't say thank you. By the age of 7, I was used to being top of my class. I was the only one who would help other pupils who had difficulties. Malala is a genius girl, my class fellows would say. I was also known for participating in everything, badminton, drama, cricket, art, even singing, though I wasn't much good. So when a new girl named Malka Inur joined our class, I didn't think anything of it. Her name means Queen of Light, and she said she wanted to be Pakistan's first female army chief. Her mother was a teacher at a different school, which was unusual as none of our mothers worked. To begin with, she didn't say much in class. The competition was always between me and my best friend Muniba, who had beautiful writing and presentation, which the examiners liked, but I knew I could beat her on content. So when we did the end-of-year exams and Malka Inur came first, I was shocked. At home, I cried and cried and had to be comforted by my mother. Around that time, we moved away from where we had been living on the same street as Muniba to an area where I didn't have any friends. On our new road, there was a girl called Safina who was a bit younger than me and we started to play together. She was a pampered girl who had lots of dolls and a shoe.